to the bottom of the story. You can listen to the Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with verses 218 to 219 from the chapter Al-Baqarah from the Holy Quran, recited by Ali Parhizgar.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Innalladhina amanu walladhina hajaru wajahadu fi sabilillah. Innalladhina amanu walladhina hajaru wajahadu fi sabilillahi ulaika yarjuna rahmatallah. أولئك يرجون رحمة الله والله غفور رحيم يسألونك عن الخمر والميسر قل فيهما إثم ومنافع للناس قل فيهما إثم كبير ومنافع للناس وإثمهما أكبر من نفعهما ويسألونك ماذا ينفقون قل العفو وكذلك يبين الله لكم الآيات لعلكم تتفكرون ويسألونك ماذا ينفقون قل العفو كذلك يبين الله لكم الآيات لعلكم تتفكرون.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Surely those who believed and those who fled their home and strove hard in the way of Allah, these hope for the mercy of Allah, and Allah is forgiving, merciful. They ask you about intoxicants and games of chance. Say, in both of them there is a great sin and means of profit for men, and their sin is greater than their profit. And they ask you as to what they should spend. Say, what you can spare. Thus does Allah make clear to you the communications that you may ponder.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines this hour. The UK's anti-monarchists say heavy-handed policing of King Charles III's coronation shows that there is no right to peaceful protests in Britain. Iran condemns the silence of the world bodies towards Israel's crimes, saying UN Security Council is responsible for protecting the Palestinians. Plus, at least seven people are killed and several others injured after an SUV plows into pedestrians in the U.S. state of Texas. Thanks for joining us. The UK's anti-monarchists have criticized the heavy-handed policing of King Charles III's coronation. They say that there is no longer a right to peaceful protest in Britain after dozens of protesters were arrested and detained into the night. The detainees included Graham Smith, who leads the anti-monarchy group known as the Republic. In a statement, Smith said his arrest was predetermined and would have occurred regardless of any evidence or action. He added that the arrests were not about protecting people from harm, but about protecting the king from embarrassment. London's Metropolitan Police said a total of 64 arrests were made during the Coronation Day protest. The detainees' charges included breach of the peace and conspiracy to cause a public nuisance.
Britain now has a new king. At the first coronation the world has seen in 70 years, the Archbishop of Canterbury crowned British royals Charles and Camilla at Westminster Abbey on Saturday, ushering in the reign of King Charles III. The main focus of British state media was the splendour and grandeur of the spectacle. However, controversy still surrounded the day. Anti-monarchy activists belonging to the peaceful Not My King protest movement were rounded up and arrested ahead of the coronation. The arrests included group leaders.
It's a completely peaceful demonstration. The police, without telling us why, without telling us where they're taking them, have arrested all the rallying organisers. They've seized all our placards. It feels like something out of a police state because we still don't know why anyone's been arrested and we still don't know where they're taking our people. You know, Britain's meant to be a democracy, but Charles isn't treating it like one.
Even before the event took place, criticism of the royal family remained relatively widespread. A survey by the National Centre for Social Research showed public support for the monarchy has fallen to a historic low. A total of 45% of respondents said either it should be abolished, was not at all important, or not very important. Young people particularly expressed embarrassment over the institution's continued existence. Elsewhere, similar polling revealed that many of the King's subjects across the Commonwealth would vote to remove the UK monarch as their head of state, raising speculation that more nations will ditch the Commonwealth in the near future. The ongoing cost of living crisis, undemocratic power, and seemingly endless scandals are among the many reasons experts believe the UK royals' popularity has plummeted.
I don't think anyone can be happy, especially looking at the economic state right now. Well, you only have to go out in the streets and some of the famous streets in London and look how many people are suffering and sleeping on the streets. And that is quite embarrassing and appalling for any sort of government, let alone a monarchy, to be proud to celebrate and spend that amount of money when people are suffering.
Why were many mainstream platforms? So what the royal family stands for today might be different, but it's very, very difficult to erase history. And they have to respect that a large portion of the public still connect them to, let's say, some incredibly sad, vicious and violent times.
The new monarch now faces many challenges, and they're not just including the social, economic and political crises which plague the nation, but also the deep divisions within his own family as well. Depending on how the king handles these many crises could heavily impact the fight for survival that the royal institution now finds itself in. Robert Carter, Windsor.
Ukraine and Russia have launched new drone strikes deep into each other's territories. Earlier we discussed about the deadly conflict between the two neighbors in our news review program. Let's hear what our guests had to say on the issue.
Time now for the news review. Stay tuned. Well, there seems to be no end in sight for the war in Ukraine as Kiev and Moscow are launching new drone attacks against one another. The cities of Sevastopol and Sakhy in Crimea were targeted by 10 drone strikes. Russian Defense Minister says it's destroyed 22 Ukrainian drones over the Black Sea. Russia has several air bases in the area, but local officials saying there was no damage. Over the past week, at least five Russian fuel facilities close to Ukraine's borders and in Crimea have come under similar attacks, and two more drones crashed on the Kremlin floor. That's Kremlin roof. Meantime, Russia has also launched widespread drone strikes on Ukraine, including on capital Kiev. Ukraine officials say that two-thirds of their country were targeted. Okay, now let me invite a couple of guests and discuss this a bit. So Glenn Deason is professor of political science with the University of Southeastern Norway, joining me from Oslo. Also with me is Esha Krishnaswamy. She's a journalist and podcaster in St. Petersburg. Good to see you both. So beginning with the Glenn in Oslo, do you have any idea, first question to begin, how things changed because soldiers were fighting, Wagner Group on part of Russia, others Russian troops, Ukrainians, missiles were used, guns were used. Now we have the war of drones by both sides. What's changed?
Well, I guess both sides are adapting to the nature of the warfare, and especially Russia has noticed, it can, with relatively cheap drones, strike a lot of important and expensive weapon systems, especially the air defense hardware which Ukraine has been stationing. So it's proving to be an ideal weapon. And furthermore, I think that this timing is quite important as well, because they're not just hitting military targets, they're also trying to hit both sides deep behind enemy lines, mm-hmm. in terms of striking anything of arms, but also fuel depots, because in a war like this, it's largely a war of logistics as well. Who can be able to deliver ammunition and fuel so the troops can perform optimally on the front line? So as both sides are preparing a huge offensive, at least seemingly so, I think that both sides have an incentive to use more drones at the moment to, mm-hmm. to try to strike and disrupt some of the logistics which the other side will depend on in order to have a successful offensive.
Okay. And Esha, given the circumstances, what's your anticipation? Where is this conflict, or maybe proxy war, as many call it. Where is this heading for?
I think it is heading for more intensification, and it's because Ukraine, in the area known as the Bakhmut area, there is two or three supply lines that lead both to Lugansk and Donetsk, which are the mainly disputed territories between Ukraine and Russia. And as Ukraine gets pushed farther west in the Bakhmut area, they need to be able to hit the logistics like fuel depots in Russia, and that's why you've seen more aggression. And on top of that, I sense that there is a sense of desperation because the ground war is not going as well as Ukraine thought earlier this year in January, and it's gone on for much longer. And they're losing a significant position in the Bakhmut area, which is very critical for the war efforts, if you look at it from the Ukrainian side. Mm-hmm. And because of that, I sense an increased desperation and more aggression from the side of Ukraine. And maybe it is also to further draw the West into the war to make this into not just a proxy war, but a real war between the West and Russia.
I see. Okay, Glenn, when two countries are at war, you know, other people, no matter if they're far or close, especially the closer ones, the natural thing for them to do is to, intervene and try to stop the war. But this is not happening. Russia is just pouring in more and more military aid, the U.S. from the other side. And, the European countries are sending their weaponry to Ukraine. And that at a time of economic hardship, lots of protest rallies, held in different European capital cities and other cities, they have cost of living crisis, they have all economic issues, yet they are helping Ukraine with all weaponry to the best of their ability. So why not talk of any negotiations? That's a natural thing to do.
Well, before it used to be controversial, at least here in the West, to talk about a proxy war. It was argued that this was Russian propaganda, but obviously now the American leadership, the political leadership, the military leaders, they're all very openly talking about this as a proxy war, so I don't think there's any need to hide that aspect anymore. But avoiding peace agreement has been something quite repetitive, because after Western governments helped to topple the government in Ukraine in 2014, a very predictable civil war with Russian support broke out. But then we had a peace agreement in 2015. But as we've learned now by the admission of the Germans and the French who helped to negotiate this, as well as the Ukrainians, there was never any real attempt to implement this. And then after these 7 years of sabotaging the Minsk agreement, there was also Ukraine and Russia was apparently also close to an agreement immediately after Russia invaded. However, as we learned as well, the British, supported by the Americans, also sabotaged this peace. And now we've seen this war been going on for a whole year. Not a single Western country has stepped up to ask for a negotiation. Even simple negotiations, such as offering to stop NATO expansion. And there's been nothing. Indeed, when China came with a proposal, the Americans rejected it before even having a proper look at it. So it's quite obvious, I think, that this is, as many American leaders, both politician and military leaders, have said, this is an opportune position for the Americans. This is an opportunity to kill Russians and weaken Russia as a strategic adversary. Not even using their own troops, they get to fight with Ukrainians. That doesn't mean that Ukraine doesn't have its legitimate grievances, and or they're not defending themselves. It just means that the United States, in their own words, are pursuing some very specific objectives, which is in American interest, and using Ukraine towards that end is in the American interest. So, so I think it's quite predictable that there's little interest by the Americans, therefore, to try to pursue a peace agreement. And the Europeans, are more or less blindly following the Americans. I think that if this offensive by the Ukrainians would fail and the Russian would be successful, thus resulting in a loss of territory, I think that would create an incentive, though, for the United States to perhaps sit down if they see that the region is shifting.
Okay, for sure. Comments, Glenn Deason, Oslo, and Esha Krishnaswamy in St. Petersburg. Thank you, and that's it for this edition of the News Review.
Iran has strongly condemned the silence of the so-called advocates of human rights in the face of Israel's daily killing of Palestinians. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani said assassination and massacre of Palestinian activists and ordinary people is now the order of the day for Zionists. He emphasized that international organizations, particularly the UN Security Council, are legally responsible for supporting the Palestinian nation in the face of the occupying regime. Iran's reaction came just one day after three Palestinian youths were killed by Israeli forces and settlers across the occupied territories. The regime has ramped up attacks on Palestinian towns and cities in recent months. More than 110 Palestinians have been killed in the occupied West Bank alone since the beginning of this year. Iran's women ice hockey team have finished runner-up in the 2023 Asia and Oceania Championship Finals. The team came second in the final match after losing to Thailand 3-1 on Sunday. The Iranian team made it to the final after winning five games in a row. They eliminated Singapore in the semifinal. This was the first time the Iranian women took part in the IIHF Women's Asian and Oceania Championship. The sport event started on April 30 in the Thai capital of Bangkok and finished on May 7. The Arab League has adopted a resolution to readmit Syria after nearly 12 years of a suspension, consolidating a regional push to normalize relations with Damascus. The decision was made at a meeting of the Arab League foreign ministers in Cairo. The Secretary General of the Pan-Arab Bloc, Ahmad Abu Ghait, even asked Syrian President Bashar al-Assad to take part in the summit if he wanted to. Damascus has reacted to the decision, calling on Arab states to show mutual respect. In a statement, the Syrian Foreign Ministry stressed the importance of joint work and dialogue to deal with challenges facing the Arab world. Syria's membership of the Arab League was suspended in November 2011. That after the conflict and foreign-backed militancy gripped the country aimed at toppling the democratically elected government of President Bashar al-Assad. Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida is in South Korea at the official invitation of President Yoon Suk-yeol. This is the first visit by a Japanese leader to South Korea since the year 2011. The trip comes as anti-Japan sentiments run high in South Korea over historical and territorial disputes still unresolved for many South Koreans. And that is for this edition of World News. It's goodbye for now.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrents fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for thee. I ask thee concerning the complaints of thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among thy servants, of a handmaid from among thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask thee, O he who owns all objects of need, which are granted by his will and hastened to his desire, that thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that thou willst, and givest me mercy from thee. Forgiveness decreases thee not, and giving injuries thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from thee: the facility to obey thee at its beginning, and the favor of thy forgiveness at its end. O he who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
Under the starry sky of the desert, from the very heart of evergreen forests, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, closer, Iran,
these are
Salam. I'm a nature enthusiast and traveler. In Close Up Iran, I introduce you to the wonders and beauties of my country, Iran. Stay with me. There is nothing as good for night sleep as rose water. It helps you to get good, sound sleep and relaxes mind and body.
And its aroma is fantastic. Tomorrow, I'm going to experience one of my best trips ever. It's the beautiful month of May, and I don't want to miss the most popular rose water festival in the world. Guess what? I'm going to take a tour to Qamsar, where the purest rose water in the world is produced. Iran Rose Water Festival is held every year in spring, usually from mid-May to the end of June, mainly hosted by the cities of Qamsar and Niyasar in Kashan, Isfahan province. Qamsar Rose Water is truly reputed in the world, and in terms of quality, it is absolutely unrivaled. Every year, in the second half of the spring, Qamsar hosts domestic and foreign tourists who travel to this city to get acquainted with how to prepare rose water and to be able to get it directly from rose water producers and other quality traditional products. In Farsi language, rose water means gulab, and the process for obtaining rose water is called gulabgiri. Here it is, Qamsar, the city of rose water. Here is where you experience a bit of history, a dose of nature, and a whole lot of culture. I said culture because rose water, or gulab, has been used by Iranians since ancient times as medicine, food, and even perfume. Even in Persian poetry, the word gulab or rose water is used in different occasions. For example, Iranian poet Maulana says, "Come out here where the roses have opened. Let soul and world meet." Oh, for moments I was overwhelmed by the aroma of roses and got separated from this world. Okay, I need to take a little walk to reach the site of the festival. Well, gula or rose water is obtained from a particular kind of rose known as Mohammadi rose in Iran. Harvesting flowers seems to be the most important part of the process. Look at these copper pots. They are very heavy. People are putting them on traditional ovens made from bricks, stones, and mud. Now they are putting the petals into the pots for boiling and adding water to the pots. During the whole process, the flame should be steady and mild. After being boiled, the extracted water is kept in special bottles. Almost every 30 kilograms of rose petals plus 80 liters of water is poured into each pot that is connected to metal pipes for the steam moving through to obtain hydrosol. I'll get some bottles of this pure rose water for my family, surely. All Iranian households have a bottle of rose water in the kitchen, as it is the main ingredient to many sweets, foods, and drinks in Iranian cuisine. Let me tell you something interesting. The holy Kaaba in Mecca is washed with rose water of Qamsar. Qamsar is a patch of paradise. So seize the day and pack your suitcase to be here. Because as the Iranian poet Hafez says, hold dear all the flowers and commune. Came to be and will wither with a breeze or a gale.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
We'll be right back. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent, a weekly show that aims to address the most significant issues in the South Asian region. And in today's episode, we'll be discussing two major issues: how American policies are distancing New Delhi from Washington, and also Russian oil finding an entry into Europe through India. So stay tuned.
In this special episode of The Subcontinent, we will discuss how American policies are distancing New Delhi from Washington. And we shall also take a look at Russian oil finding an entry into Europe through India.
The authoritative U.S. foreign policy is non-adaptive to the dynamic geopolitical trends in the contemporary world. The policing policy of America to meet its economic and security goals has now proved counterproductive for the country. Since long, the U.S. foreign policy has worked to suppress and prevent the emergence of other countries on the global scene. However, this strategy has now brought damaging results for the United States, alienating its long-term allies like Saudi Arabia, France, Brazil, and also India.
Positioning itself as greater and superior than the rest of the world, the foreign policy of the United States is being used as a tool to safeguard its global hegemony. The country has been using it to push for global alignment to meet its economic and strategic goals. In the process to secure its gains, the U.S. has been meddling in other countries' domestic affairs, subverting their governance and creating turmoil. Claiming to help the countries through humanitarian intervention, the U.S. has not been able to accept the multipolar reality of the world, where different countries are interconnected to progress in their own ways. The foreign policy establishment of the United States believes that the country is helping other nations to be on the right side of the history by following the much-hyped American values and sharing the economic approach of Washington. However, this belief is proving detrimental for the Indo-U.S. relations, alienating India, a country America has sought partnership with to restrain the growing influence of China in the region. According to foreign policy, despite a shared democratic system and weariness of China, the U.S. and India do not share a similar worldview.
India and the U.S. for decades have held divergent worldviews, pursuing conflicting objectives. The imposing behavior of the U.S., forcing India to toe its line, is further distancing New Delhi from Washington. A recent survey conducted by the U.S.-based business intelligence company Morning Consult shows Indians consider the U.S. as the second greatest military threat to their country after China. It's interesting to mention that Indians also place greater blame on Washington and NATO for the Russia-Ukraine war than on the Russian President Vladimir Putin.
The U.S. belief that the geopolitical and economic tensions between New Delhi and Beijing will lead to closer ties between India and the United States has failed on the ground. There are remarkable differences between the U.S. and India on geopolitical issues and other policies. India, being one of the world's largest economies, supporting a powerful army with a thriving young population, is not ready to accept dictates from a foreign country. New Delhi has been showing that it can be forced to accept the policies of the United States on different geopolitical issues, ranging from trade, climate, Russia-Ukraine war, or its relations with its neighbors. According to the result of the study conducted by a U.S.-based company, 60% Indians want their government to continue purchasing the Russian oil, thus showing their disdain against the meddling of the United States in the affairs of their country. The unwanted interference of the United States in the political and foreign affairs of India has made the Indian population perceive that Washington is unable to understand the values and policies of India, and in the process trying to damage the interests of the South Asian nation.
Now, to have more insight on this, we are joined by geopolitical analyst Mr. Sayed Muhammad Ali from Islamabad. First of all, welcome to the program, sir. Now, the U.S. believes that it's leading nations towards the right side of history. So to what extent is this arrogant thinking shaping the foreign policy of the country and proving counterproductive on the ground?
Well, the reality of international politics is this, that we are living in the last days of the post-Second World War Western world order. And when you view the U.S. policy right now towards the world in general and the developing world in particular, you can interpret it as a U.S. attempt to dominate and preserve the status quo by maintaining its disproportionate influence over the world institutions, policies, and countries. Although the recent changes in the world order, the rise of some countries, the revival of some countries, the resurgence of some powers has complicated the U.S. Pax Americana agenda, which is why I think there are new opportunities emerging, new alliances being built, which is making it very difficult for the U.S. to continue to dominate the world the way it did in the last few years.
Mr. Sayed Ali, the friendship with India was an action to contain China's rise in the region. However, it seems Sino-India tensions have not helped the Indo-U.S. relations. So what's your take on this?
I think it was somewhat naive on the part of Washington to expect India to become the pivot of the U.S. Indo-Pacific strategy and in the containment of China project. I think the leading strategic thinkers in the U.S. are beginning to recognize the limits of Indian security commitment towards the U.S. interests. And I think it is also reflected in the recent U.S. Security strategy that it distinguished between alliances and partnerships. And it is very important to notice that the word used for India was not a strategic ally, but a strategic partner. And how the U.S. explains the difference is basically ally is a country which shares not just the interests, but also the values of the U.S. Whereas a strategic partner like India is a country with which the U.S. expects some common interests, but do not share the values with it.
Sir, Indians regard the U.S. as the second largest military threat against their country. How do you view this estrangement of Indians towards the U.S.?
I think it is a very important issue, which is often ignored in international politics, that the Indian strategic thinking is characterized by three key features. Number one, hatred towards the Muslim minorities. Number two, distrust towards the Western powers. And number three, to maintain its strategic autonomy, which means that it should not commit itself with any major power completely. So these are the three key features of the Indian strategic character. So if you see that when India tested its first nuclear weapon, which it ironically described as Smiling Buddha in 1974, it was not aimed against China, because China built its nuclear weapons more than a decade ago, and they had not any major conflict in the 70s. But it was the Indira Doctrine, which was very similar to the U.S. Monroe Doctrine, in which the Indian strategic elite and the political leadership saw Indian Ocean as an Indian lake, which India should dominate. And it did not want any power, including the U.S., to restrain or constrain the Indian interests in this region. So that is something which is very interesting. And since the anti-Western perspective is quite deeply rooted in the Indian diplomatic and strategic elite, I think it is very important for the international community to not neglect the deep-rooted Indian thinking that India should be a great power in its own right, and it should not be subordinate to any other power, including its current partner, the United States.
Last but not least, sir, the U.S. is against independent-minded countries punishing the non-adherent nations to force compliance. So do you think this flawed U.S. policy will distance India further from America?
I think it is a very important issue that the Western powers, particularly the U.S., narrowly interpret its values and the international system. And it is very important for peace, progress, and stability around the world and in different regions for the U.S. to respect and tolerate and understand the diverse value systems, ideologies, political systems, and cultures of different countries and civilizations. Because if different value systems are perceived and interpreted as a threat, and efforts are made to change regimes, to change political ideologies, to interfere in the political system of different countries, then obviously this will not be seen as a favorable, mutually beneficial relationship by most countries. And you can immediately see this is the problem that the U.S. is facing with China, with Russia, with North Korea, with Iran, with so many other countries, that the issue is not their power. The issue is their political system, their ideology and culture. And we have witnessed recently in the U.S. Attack on Afghanistan that they tried to change the culture, the religion, the ideology and way of life of Afghan people, but it did not succeed.
On that note, I would like to thank geopolitical analyst Mr. Sayyid Muhammad Ali from Islamabad for being on the program. Thank you, sir. Now, let's see what people around the world had to say.
David Santoro tweeted, I've been in India for nearly a week, and I'm more convinced than ever that if the U.S. wants to advance U.S.-Indian relations, it needs to engage India in the same way France does. That is, stop trying to rally India behind you, just focus on areas where cooperation is possible. Ivan Wan wrote, except the U.S. is increasingly pushing India away by pressuring them to cut off ties with Russia. Baharat Now tweeted, India has been very clear regarding its independent foreign policy, even under immense pressure from both blocs, something the U.S. is not used to. India has chosen to serve its own national interests as a true rising power in a brave new multipolar world. Diva says, is the U.S. really helping India grow its economy? We have seen no serious attempt by the U.S. and EU to decouple from China, only talks and lectures. I think the USA will create a conflict and run away. India is not your vassal like Japan and South Korea, where you control foreign policy.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Russia has found a new way to maintain the demand for its oil supply. Despite the recent ban on Russian oil imports, it's continuing to provide Europe with fuel via India. New Delhi has been buying cheap Russian oil and selling it to Europe at a higher price after its refinement. According to a recent report by Russian analytics firm Kepler, India has become Europe's largest supplier of refined fuels this month, while simultaneously buying record amounts of Russian crude oil.
According to the International Energy Agency, Russia is one of the world's largest oil producers and exporters. In the recent years, Europe has heavily relied on Russian oil imports, making up nearly 30% of the continent's total crude oil supply. However, since the Russian-Ukraine conflict in early 2022, the European Union imposed sanctions on Russia, which included a ban on the import of oil transported by sea. The ban was followed by an embargo on the fuel imports from the country. Nevertheless, the European Union sanctions have not prevented countries such as India from purchasing discounted Russian oil. Following the ban, Europe's reliance on Indian crude oil products has grown rapidly. According to Kepler statistics, Europe's imports of refined fuel from India is set to surge to more than 360,000 barrels per day, surpassing imports from Saudi Arabia. Victor Kitona, lead crude analyst at Kepler Energy Analysis Company, said that despite all the sanctions that have been announced, Russian oil has still found its way to Europe, and the increase in fuel exports from India to the West is a good example in this regard. He added that this scenario was inevitable given all the oil that India buys from Russia.
Russia has emerged as a major oil supplier to India for the first time in the 2023 fiscal year. According to the data provided by the Kepler company, the entry of Russian oil shipments to India is expected to surpass 2 million barrels per day, representing almost 44% of New Delhi's overall oil imports. This surge in demand for Russian oil is due to the fact that India has been buying oil at discounted rates from Moscow amid the Western sanctions on the country since the Russia-Ukraine conflict.
According to the data by the Indian Ministry of Commerce and Industry, Russia was the largest exporter of crude oil to India by value in February, in spite of the Western price cap of $60 per barrel. The price cap kept by the Western countries was designed to limit Russian oil revenues while keeping the oil itself flowing to avoid a global price shock. Crude oil imports from Russia to India stood at $3.35 billion in February, followed by Saudi Arabia at $2.30 billion and Iraq at $2.03 billion. According to a Bloomberg report, more than half of Russia's seaborne oil exports went to the European Union and G7 countries before Moscow was imposed with sanctions in the early 2022. However, since the sanctions on Russia, the scenario has changed. Presently, as per Kepler's data, India has become Europe's largest supplier of refined fuels. While the Indian supply of refined fuels has helped meet the EU's demand, its direct flow from Russia has been cut off, ultimately boosting demand for Moscow's oil barrels. This has resulted in higher transportation costs and more competition for European refineries that cannot access cheap Russian oil. This development has come amid wider market scrutiny about the region's diesel imports. This new development has not only challenged Europe's energy policy, but also demonstrated the ever-changing global oil market dynamics.
Now, to have more insight on this, we are joined by strategic expert Lieutenant General Shokin Chauhan from India. First of all, welcome to the program, sir. Now, the energy cooperation between Russia and India is growing. What implications will it have on the global balance of power?
To talk about the global balance of power or the global energy balance of power with India buying Russian oil, we have to take a bit of a view backwards to, the first time that oil was used as a weapon in 1973. And from that time onwards, India has been aware that because she has no access to oil, we have to get and plan access to our own oil in our own way. So actually all this came to an head in 1998, when you remember that Saudi Arabia decided that she would give oil to Pakistan at lower than normal rates. And India realized that we had to do it on our own, and that's the time when we started investing in oil all over the world. And we have investments in Russia, and because of those investments, we are now have access to cheaper Russian oil, and as a result have been able to get over this oil shock that when the oil giants raised their prices. India was able to prevent these prices being raised in India because they had access to cheaper Russian oil. So it does matter eventually, but India has been able to use this crisis to stand up on her own.
Lieutenant, in light of the increasing demand for Indian refined fuel in Europe, how do you see India's role in shaping the global oil market, and what challenges and opportunities lie ahead for the South Asian country?
You asked about India emerging as a alternative or as a global refining power, because we have access to how this world market moves now is like this, that India has access to cheaper Russian oil. That cheaper Russian oil is brought into India and refined. We are one of the world's largest refiners of oil. I think second or third in the world. And with that ability to refine oil, India has been able to utilize this cheaper Russian oil, refine it, and resell it to the European market at a higher price. And that has helped the Indian economy. As you know, the Indian population has become the largest in the world. We are a young population. We are growing very, very strongly. We need access to more money. We are developing our infrastructure. So all that requires money. And this ability of India to get this cheaper Russian oil, refine it in India, and resell it at a higher price shall certainly help the Indian economy. Along with this help to the Indian economy, since oil and economics has always been on the world stage as a geopolitical weapon, I would say this is the first time that India is realizing that we have to increase our ability, improve our economy, if we are to have a say in the geopolitics of the world.
Lieutenant, the European Union has put a ban on Russian oil imports. So how has this changed the global oil trade?
You know, Alireza, I must take our mind back to the global crisis about Europe's decision to ban Russian oil. So what exactly happened was that when Europe followed the American lead to ban Russian oil, she went through a crisis of the availability of oil and the availability of expensive oil for her citizens. Europe, as you know, is not a growing market anymore. Economically, she is suffering. And this Russia-Ukraine war couldn't have come at a worse time for the European economy. The Indian ability to get cheaper Russian oil came from an ability that we had made a number of excellent financial decisions to invest in the Russian oil infrastructure from 2002 onwards. And because of that, India was able to get Russian oil at almost $10 less than the rest of the world.
Last but not least, how do you see the future of energy trade between Russia, India and Europe, and what factors are likely to shape this trade in the coming years?
That's a very interesting question about the future of the economic trade or the oil trade between India and Russia and how it is affecting Europe's economy. I feel that over the next 2 to 5 years, this will continue. The reason being that I don't think the Russian-Ukraine war is going to end. I don't think that the Americans will lift their sanctions on Russia. And as a result of it, Russia will continue to have to depend upon friends like India to pick up her oil, give her money, and also help her sell her oil to the world, her natural resource. But why do I say only 2 to 5 years? The issue is that over the next decade, the world will move away from the use of fossil fuels, especially to power their transportation. there are, as you know, great strides being taken in the batteries that are being used now to power the transportation all across the world. As the batteries become better and as they have the capability to have more power and to keep that power for a longer period of time, and they become cheaper to use than fossil fuels, the world will automatically shift to the EV kind of vehicles or to any other technology that is available as a domestic resource.
There you have it, strategic expert Lieutenant General Shokin Chauhan from India. Thank you for being on the program, sir. Now let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Ben Norton tweeted, "The EU sanctioned Russia and boycotted its oil, yet is still buying it indirectly from India at a higher price. This is ironically fueling both de-dollarization and inflation in the Eurozone, where workers' real wages dropped 6.5% from 2020 to 2022. SL Canton wrote, "Are these two facts related? India is importing record amounts of oil from Russia. India is exporting record amounts of fuel and diesel to Europe. The irrational US and EU sanctions." Norbert Elikis says, "India is importing crude from Russia and selling to Europe. Guess who's being benefited? India has now become one of the largest suppliers of refined fuel to Europe. Also imported record crude oil from Russia."
And that was our episode about the Indo-US relations and Russian oil finding its way to Europe via India. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take great care.
In the limelight.
When Iran and Syria recently inked a series of cooperation